This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
A journalist was murdered in Malta. A conviction in her case leaves lots of unanswered questions. One of them, what investigations would Caruana Galizia be taking on today if she were alive?
Daphne Caruana Galizia would be solving her own murder.
I'm Marco Werman. Also, Iran's military shot down a passenger jet last year. Friends and family are still grieving the 176 people who died, like this professor who lost a student.
It's been a year. The pain is still raw. For me personally, I have a daughter the same age.
Today, we learn more about what happened to that plane and combating vaccine misinformation with personal stories.
We all share our own different perspectives as to what we felt with the vaccine. It's like we did it first. We're still here. We're still alive.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. Glad you could be with us. Today, Ghana in West Africa became the first country to receive a shipment of coronavirus vaccine from COVAX. A flight carrying 600,000 doses from the Global Vaccine Collaborative landed in the capital Accra this morning. The doses were unloaded onto trucks and will start being administered next week. Ghana is one of the countries that has impressed and confounded medical professionals because it seems to have a curiously low COVID-19 death rate. Scientists are trying to figure out why some low- and middle-income countries like Ghana have so far been able to avoid the worst impact of the virus. Siddhartha Mukherjee is one of those scientists. He's a biologist, oncologist, physician, and author. Mukherjee told me he sees the arrival of the COVAX vaccines in Ghana today as a moment to celebrate.
It makes me delighted that the vaccines are getting to the places where lots of people need to be vaccinated, even though mortality in most of these places has been lower, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, with the exception of South Africa and India. We still need to vaccinate because asymptomatic infection there's a lot of it. So, for instance, in New Delhi, India, the rate of infected people has reached 56 to 60%. And as you can imagine, if you carry an infection, you give the virus a chance to mutate, and those mutations can eventually become resistant to vaccination. So I think it's a wonderful thing that the vaccines are finally reaching places like Ghana.
Yeah, and Ghana is one of those countries that has not been slammed by the pandemic. How has Ghana fared so far? How seriously have officials and the public taken the disease? And in terms of infections and deaths, how does it all translate?
In terms of deaths, Ghana has fared very well. I don't know the last number of deaths reported in Ghana, but it was on the order of hundreds. Just to give you another comparison, Nigeria, there is COVID around, but most of the infections have been asymptomatic or mildly symptomatic. And the death rate is, on a per capita basis, 1/100 of the death rate in the United States.
Have Ghanaians been wearing masks? Has the messaging from the Ghanaian government been strong and leaning into science?
The Ghanaians have been wearing masks, although if you ask people in Ghana, as I did, mask wearing has been intermittent. I heard this astonishing story from someone and confirmed it, that in Accra, there was a long line of people waiting at a bill payment center where they were wearing masks, but they were also exchanging masks, which you can imagine is the worst of all possible scenarios.
Right. So let's look at an extreme example that has really confounded experts. Daravi. I've actually spent time there. Asia's largest slum, one of the largest slums in the world, located in the middle of Mumbai, one of the largest cities in the world. Describe Daravi for us and why a year ago it was just the kind of place experts were certain would be hit hard by COVID.
People live cheek by jowl. It's extraordinarily crowded. There are multi-generational families living in small houses, and people in the town, the younger crowd, sort of goes in and out of the city all the time. Very close neighborhoods, small streets, And so this is exactly the kind of place that was expected to have a lethal wave of COVID.
So what happened? Did the virus even get a foothold?
The virus got a foothold. People suspect that the seroprevalence is on the order of 50, 60, 70%. So there's virus. The virus got to Dharavi. But for, again, for reasons that we can talk about, some mysterious and some less mysterious, the number of deaths was in the hundreds. Remember, this is a town of a million people, or a shanty town of a million people living in multi-generation close-quartered families. So there's a mystery.
So this is a huge question puzzling everyone in global public health, this disparity between countries where there are huge infection rates and deaths and others where there are not. Experts like you are sifting through this constellation of factors, and there are many. Could you name a few? Like, what do you think is causing this?
Yeah, I think, you know, the biggest one probably is age. The countries that where the median age is younger, like India, where the median age is 27, 28, compared to countries like Italy and Spain, where the median age is 45, 46, and the United States, similarly, 45, 46, have done worse than countries where they're younger people. And that's because COVID tends to kill, and the mortality is very skewed towards older people. But that itself is not the full explanation and can't be the full explanation. And that's partly because if you compare a country like Mexico, where the median age is almost the same as India, Mexico has done much worse than India on a per capita basis, obviously done much worse than Nigeria and Ghana on a per capita basis. So that's not the full answer. So that's one answer, the median age. The second answer is the government response. So countries like New Zealand, Australia, and other places have essentially drawn up their drawbridges, as it were, restricted travel, imposed very strict quarantine rules, etc. So that's the second trend that we've seen. And then there are some intriguing hypotheses that prior immunity because of the number of pathogens that people encounter in countries like Nigeria and India and other places, slums or shanty towns like Dharavi, are giving some kind of protective immunity to people such that even though they acquire the virus and actually have an infection, they have particularly T cell responses to the virus, and that suppresses the worst ravages of COVID. One last point important to make is that in various analyses, people have tried to look to see if the host genetics have much to do with COVID susceptibility. That will take a really deep analysis.
Are you confident we're going to solve this?
Oh, yes, I'm pretty confident we're going to solve it. It's a puzzle, but it's also potentially a puzzle with multiple answers. There's not going to be one answer. And it'll take months and months for epidemiologists to run through all of this.
Siddhartha Mukherjee is a physician, biologist, oncologist, and author. You can read his article, Why Does a Pandemic Seem to Be Hitting Some Countries Harder Than Others, in The New Yorker. Doctor, thank you very much for unpacking this for us. It is a fascinating question.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
The COVID-19 vaccine arsenal looks poised to get a boost. A review by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration found Johnson & Johnson's single-dose COVID-19 shot is safe and effective. That paves the way for an emergency use approval in the U.S. that's expected within days and would send a strong signal across the globe. At the same time, each week, it seems, we're also learning new details about variants of the virus spreading around the globe. So what does that mean for the pandemic? The World's Alana Gordon reports on why one infectious disease expert sees reasons for worry and for hope.
William Hanitch thinks about three main variants of this coronavirus a lot. He's an epidemiologist at Harvard's Center for Communicable Disease Dynamics. He and other scientists call them variants of concern. There's B.1.1.7, first discovered in the UK, B.1, first identified in Brazil, and B.1.351, first found in South Africa. These variants each have a number of mutations, more than he and others would have expected. And in labs, they seem to affect how the virus interacts with human cells.
And so them all taken together is why we are anxious about them.
B.1.351, first found in South Africa, has a mutation that seems to make some antibodies less effective against the virus. But Hanisch says to this point,
even though there appears to be some reduction, it's not likely that it's going to be enough to make a major impact upon the efficacy of the vaccines.
The vaccines also appear to prevent severe disease.
That, in and of itself, is a good thing and speaks to the merit of vaccination in general.
So despite all the developments with variants, he sees reasons to be optimistic long-term and an urgency to get going with these vaccine campaigns. In this moment, the variant that still perplexes him is P1.
We don't understand, I think, at all well enough what made Manaus happen.
Hanage is referring to an area of Brazil that experienced a second surge in cases after large percentages of that population had already been infected. But his biggest concern right now is variants that have been found to be more transmissible, like B117, first ID'd in the UK.
Which means it is more difficult to control, both in terms of the basic actions that we're able to take. And it also means we're going to need to vaccinate a higher proportion of the population in order to control it.
He doesn't want the world to let its guard down in preventing the spread of this coronavirus through policies that help people socially distance, that provide personal protective gear to health workers. He says that's all the more important as he and other scientists try to learn even more about this evolving coronavirus. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
Epidemiologist William Hanage spoke with The World this week as part of our regular Facebook Live series with Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. You can watch a video of the full conversation at theworld.org. A Maltese hitman has been sentenced to 15 years for killing a reporter, but that does not bring to an end the search for justice for investigative journalist Daphne Caruana Galizia. She was reporting in Malta on allegations unearthed by the Panama Papers in 2017 when she was murdered. Her family believes she was killed because she was getting too close to exposing crimes by Malta's political elite. Maltese journalist Manuel D'Elia is the co-author of Murder on the Malta Express, Who Killed Daphne Caruana Galizia. He joins us now from Macaba, Malta. In a sentence or two, Manuel, can you remind us about the career of investigative journalist Daphne Caruana Galizia and what she was working on when she was killed?
Daphne Caruana Galizia had been a journalist in Malta for over 30 years. She was known as a one-woman WikiLeaks. She worked on major scandals that rocked the Labour Party government over the last, 3 years of her life, until the day she died.
The sentence yesterday of Vincent Muscat does not solve every question in this case. What does the hitman's confession and conviction mean to people in Malta?
Well, let's start with the positive. This is the first person to have been convicted and is being punished for the killing of Daphne Caruana Galizia. But he's the gopher, the very bottom of the food chain. He had been insisting since April 2018 to go for a plea bargain because he felt he didn't deserve a life sentence. All he was a watcher. The significance of this might be, and one hopes is that he becomes now a witness against the other conspirators, starting with the assassins, the other two assassins that are charged with killing Daphne Caruana Galizia. For the first time now, we have an eyewitness on the murder scene. And he should be also corroborating the evidence of the witness who's pointing at the alleged mastermind of the crime, businessman, multimillionaire Jürgen Fenech.
So you said with a fairly great certainty that this man, Jürgen Fenech, is the intellectual author of the murder. Where is he and what's his situation?
He's been under arrest since November of 2019. He's been known of having bribed senior ministers in Joseph Muscat's government in order to get a major energy contract. The bribes were supposed to be paid in Panama companies exposed in the Panama Papers, exposing the prime minister's chief of staff and his energy minister. So we've had our eyes on Jürgen Fenech for some time. The evidence we've heard against him in court is compelling. The frustrating bit is that the slow process of criminal justice in Malta means that we don't have a date yet when he will be facing a jury of his peers. And obviously he's innocent until proven guilty.
What is the likelihood that Fenech will eventually be heard in court?
Let's say I'm optimistic that he will face justice at some point. However, Malta is dealing with what is essentially a mafia crime, and I worry that Malta is not equipped to fight organized crime, to push back on the infiltration that we have suffered over the last years.
What investigations would Caruana Galizia be taking on today if she were alive?
Daphne Caruana Galizia would be solving her own murder. I remember the day that she was killed. Many thousands of people who habitually followed her blog went into her blog to understand her interpretation of what had happened. Obviously, it was silent. Daphne Caruana Galizia, she had her finger on the culture of the country. She understood that not only there was corruption, because there's corruption everywhere, but the attitude to corruption was corrupt, that people admired corruption. She explained that, and that is what caused her to die.
Manuel D'Elia is a co-author of Murder on the Malta Express, Who Killed Daphne Caruana Galizia. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up on the show, justice for Syrians in a German courtroom. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. After 10 years of civil war and violence in Syria, a verdict in a German court is raising hopes of justice for Syrians. A former member of a secret police force was convicted today as an accessory to crimes against humanity, a secret police force overseen by Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Ayad al-Harib was sentenced to 4.5 years behind bars for facilitating the torture of prisoners in Syria. It is the first time a court has ruled in the case of a Syrian official accused of crimes against humanity. Mohammed al-Abdallah is the executive director of the Syria Justice and Accountability Center in Washington. Mohammed, how significant is this case when it comes to justice and accountability in Syria?
It is indeed a significant case that there is a case already being reviewed by a non-Syrian court, a German court in this case, about crimes committed in Syria. This is significant in a couple of aspects. It started already during the active conflict, which is kind of a precedent. We don't see usually trials for crimes against the humanity starting while the conflict still is going on. And the other aspect is the court provided the families and the victims and the survivors of that very branch of intelligence where they were held before to show up in court, and it became a forum for them to express their opinion, to share their stories. It also helped human rights groups to kind of test their evidence and documentation for the crimes committed. Those evidence and documentation were examined by a German court in this case, and apparently they were admissible and they were held up in a court of law.
Was there testimony that you know about in this case that stood out to you, that kind of got to the heinous nature of this torture?
Honestly, in today's case, because this case was a part of the bigger case, which is putting a colonel, Anwar Aslan, on a trial. But recently, the German court decided to separate the cases because, indeed, Iyad al-Gharib did not have actually plaintiffs against him personally testifying against him. He's a very low-ranking officer in that branch. And that's the reason why he got kind of a low sentencing, if you want to describe it this way, for alleged crimes against humanity. And if you look at that bigger case, Anwar Aslan case, yes, 35 people testified against him. People challenged him in his face, but did not happen exactly with Iyad al-Gharib. The only evidence in this case with Iyad, in today's case, was his own statement when he applied for asylum in Germany, which ended up used against him in kind of a self-incriminating context here.
I was going to ask you, how did the Syrian intelligence officer arrive in Germany and end up in court in the first place?
Now, in the case of Iyad al-Gharib, Iyad defected in 2012 from the Syrian intelligence services. He actually fought against them with the Free Syrian Army, and he ended up leaving to Syria when ISIS took over because he was fleeing ISIS. And he took the boat with his family, just like any other refugee, and ended up in Germany, crossing the borders illegally till he reached Germany. And contrary, if you look on Colonel Raslan's case, he waited till 2015. He did not really defect. He just left the force because his family was threatened by the opposition. And in his trial, he was still defending the Syrian government and denying any act of torture that ever happened in the branches. And he was sponsored by the opposition. He was given a letter that Germany issued him a special visa, and he had a nice trip of flight from Amman, Jordan, to Germany.
And to clarify, Mohammed, as I understand it, a trial like this has not only not happened in Syria, it's also the first time a ruling on a Syrian official has happened outside Syria. That's also significant, right?
Correct. That's significant. There is no possibility to have such trials in Syria, at least in this current time. The ICC, the International Criminal Court, has been blocked by Russia's veto in the Security Council. We cannot get a referral to the ICC. The only possible justice avenue for Syrians was to pursue their perpetrators in national courts if they managed to arrive to Europe. And there's a couple of cases around Syria involved in Europe from 2015. It involved like lower level soldiers who appeared in pictures stepping over dead bodies or torturing other people, but not an official from the intelligence services. This is the first case indeed.
I'm speaking with Mohammed Al-Abdallah from the Syria Justice and Accountability Center in Washington about a guilty verdict handed down today in Germany. Mohammed, who are the German prosecutors working with to provide evidence against these people? I mean, presumably the prosecutors have sources of intelligence, even sources close to Assad, right?
Not exactly. I mean, they worked clearly with the civil society, with the human rights groups who were able to help basically providing some documentation. The documentation ranged from witnesses who testified about what they've seen, but the former detainees in that specific branch who came and said, basically, we were detained and tortured and we've seen X and Z being tortured. And also the Caesar photos, the very unfortunate and famous photos here, the military photographer who defected in 2015 and took with him thousands of images of dead bodies showing what's happening, the horror of torture happening in security agencies and prisons. Apparently, a couple of those pictures showing the number of that branch written, every dead body was pictured in those photos by the military police, had a number on the forehead of the dead. And the number was corresponding with the branch that they were killed in. And the branch 251, which is the case here about the two officers from branch 251, appeared on those pictures. So there were dead bodies and they were tortured coming from that branch. And nobody can deny this fact.
So for a landmark legal ruling, I'm wondering, Mohammed, what kind of message this conviction and sentencing sends to the regime of Bashar al-Assad and other human rights violators in Syria?
It's important. It sends a clear message that the impunity the government in Syria enjoyed for decades, abusing Syrians, killing them, torturing them, terrifying them, and terrorizing them is cannot continue like before. Even if we cannot reach you inside Syria, we basically will try to follow you outside. To be also perfectly honest on the expectations and managing the expectations of people, the scope of universal jurisdiction, which is the legal principle that this trial came under, the scope is very limited. Do not apply to heads of state and to ministers. So Assad couldn't be tried, for example, in the national court in Germany because he has a head of state immunity. But we can try a couple of people and his security agencies if they manage to arrive to Germany or to Europe in general, to a country apply the same universal jurisdiction principle. It's important decision. It is history in the conflict in Syria and clearly kind of coinciding with the 10th anniversary of the conflict. It speaks also to the efforts of the victims and civil society, how they managed to take up this type of work quickly and not waiting for a peace agreement and settlement like it happened in other countries. We're hoping a better future for Syria, and this case could actually be a good hope in that direction.
Mohammed Al-Abdallah is the executive director of the Syria Justice and Accountability Center in Washington, speaking with us about a landmark guilty verdict today in Germany for a Syrian official charged with crimes against humanity. Mohammed, thank you for explaining this.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
You rely on us to bring you important voices with context and firsthand perspectives from around the globe. We bring you those voices every day on the radio, but also in our newsletter. It's called Top of the World, and our dedicated team here sends it out via email weekday mornings. Sign up by heading to theworld.org/newsletters. We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. Hello, Marco here. This past year, listeners continued to show their unwavering support for The World. Together, we raised over $100,000, thanks to the following people that helped us reach our goal. Stephen Taima, Donald Feinberg, Corey Hajim, Gary Peltzner, Skip Fernandez, Douglas Beach, Tim Campen, Ravi Parapudi, Martha Thomas, and M. Luthera Malat. Thank you all for helping us bring human-centered journalism to listeners all around the world. The main opposition leader in Belarus has been in exile since August. Her senior advisor still believes victory against the current president is possible.
We still will prevail. Our tactic of peaceful protest, nonviolent protest, is very efficient.
Svetlana Tikhanovskaya calls her supporters back to the streets to demonstrate for democracy. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Now that coronavirus vaccines are available, the big public health hurdle is getting people to roll up their sleeves. All week, we're looking at outreach efforts in hard-hit, historically marginalized communities. We're visiting Pakistan, France, the UK, and China, and today, the US, where vaccine misinformation is a particular hurdle to access for migrant farm workers. The World's Daisy Contreras explores how grassroots organizations are debunking myths and getting people vaccinated.
Hola, compañeros. ¿Cómo están? Estamos aquí.
Luz Gallegos stands at the edge of a large green field in Riverside County in Southern California. It's windy but clear out. She holds up a flyer and in Spanish explains about an upcoming vaccine drive. She urges farm workers to come sign up and get vaccinated. Gallegos is with TODEC. It's a nonprofit organization in the Coachella Valley region helping migrants get the right COVID-19 information about testing and vaccination. Gallegos says they need to cut through the fear that persists after the negative immigration rhetoric and policies of the Trump administration.
So this is the aftermath. It's not only harming immigrants, but it's harming the entire community because with the pandemic, it's spreading like fire.
Also spreading like fire is vaccine misinformation. Migrants don't always trust the government. Gallegos says the biggest myth she hears is that vaccines have a tracking chip. And so workers have questions about when she got her vaccine.
And they get curious. Oh, how was it? What did you feel? And we all share our own different perspectives as what we felt with the vaccine. It's like we did it first. We're still here. We're still alive. We don't have a chip within ourselves.
Farm workers have been one of the hardest hit groups during the pandemic. They don't always get to practice safe social distancing, for example. There is also a language barrier. Many are undocumented, and there is a fear of deportation. Gallego says if they fall ill, farm workers don't go see a doctor, worried that using public help will hurt their chances of getting a green card in the future. But now there are vaccines available for all farm workers there. They are being considered essential workers. Gallegos and her team of volunteers tell workers that all they need is their work ID or a pay stub to qualify. No one will track them, even if they're undocumented. 2 hours away, though, in Ventura County, vaccines are not available to farm workers unless they're 65 years and older. But there are still people working to get information out.
Quédate con Radio Indígena 94.1 FM.
That's Radio Indígena, or Indigenous Radio. It broadcasts a mix of music and informational segments in Spanish and in Indigenous languages, like Mixteco, Triqui, and Zapoteco. Thousands of farm workers speak those languages.
Mi nombre es Alondra Mendoza y mi compañero Juan Carlos Díaz. Hola, compañero. Muy buenos días. ¿Cómo estás?
Muy buenos días. Gracias. Muy bien.
Hosts Alondra Mendoza and Juan Carlos Díaz run a health segment. They take turns answering questions from listeners. One person asks if it's true the vaccine will cause infertility. Díaz answers in Mixteco. That's just a myth, he explains. Mendoza then translates the answer in Spanish. Both Mendoza and Díaz have been volunteer hosts on the program for just a few months, but they've quickly become trusted community voices. Another host, Lidia Perez, says she feels like a celebrity. People recognize her and approach her to ask questions.
O sea, si los veo, ¿verdad? Los saludo desde de lejos y les digo, no te desanimes, todo va a estar bien.
If I see people, she says, I try to inform and encourage them. Perez is from the Mexican state of Oaxaca and worked in the California fields for over 20 years. She mostly spoke Mixteco then. She says she knows what it feels like to feel alone working in the field, especially if you don't speak Spanish or English. Back in Riverside County, Luz Gallegos with a nonprofit TODEC has just finished another long day helping get farm workers vaccinated. She shows me some photos through Zoom.
So this is today. This is the farm. See how the nurse is set up?
The county health department sets up under a huge tent, sort of like a greenhouse. They're right in the middle of a field. Gallegos and other volunteers help farm workers with language translations in case the nurses aren't bilingual. About 300 farm workers get vaccinated per day. It's an incredible feat, Gallegos says. She hopes the county's vaccine campaign will be a model for other counties and states to follow. She's trying to show the needs of vulnerable communities.
And right now, it's up to us as an organization to continue elevating the realities, elevating the challenges.
And despite the loss and pain the migrant farm worker community has faced this past year, Gallegos says they're resilient. For the world, I'm Daisy Contreras.
Let's turn our attention to the former Soviet Republic of Belarus. Most opposition leaders there have either been in exile or in prison in Belarus for months, following protests last summer that carried into the fall. They were demonstrating against the rigged election of President Alexander Lukashenko, who's ruled the country for more than 26 years. Now, exiled opposition leader Svetlana Tikhanovskaya is calling people to hit the streets again. With me now is Franek Vyachorka, senior advisor to Svetlana Tikhanovskaya. You and Ms. Tikhanovskaya are both exiled in Lithuania, along with other opposition advisors. Tikhanovskaya has been there since August. What have you and your team been doing? What are you able to do in exile?
You're right that it's impossible to do everything when you're in different country. That the real heroes are those who are continuing fighting in Belarus, in cities, towns, organizing protests every day, and who are risking with their freedom and lives and health by protesting against Lukashenko. We are trying to help, first of all, to raise awareness about Belarus issue and to get support of different countries, European Union, United States, and on the other hand, to coordinate somehow and to inspire, to strengthen people on the ground by being in touch with them, by studying their needs and coordinating their activities.
So the protests went into the autumn. Are you saying that people are still on the streets of Belarus protesting?
Yeah, people protest, but not big marches, small rallies. 3 months, we had big marches every Sunday, 200,000-300,000 people on the streets, but later they became smaller and smaller. And now we have every day different kind of protests, but they are usually 100 people, 150 people in different parts of Belarus.
So how has the opposition movement actually changed tactics since the summer and fall of mass protests? And do you think you're still effective?
I'm a big supporter of big marches, of course. I believe that it's impossible to make revolution without people in the downtown. When they are protesting, when they form the crowd and the whole country and the whole world is watching this protest. So I think we became less visualized, but the protest is ongoing. So at this moment, we are in this survival mode. We are trying to save infrastructure and build capacity in order to strike again in springtime when it will get warmer.
Right. Has the pause in large protests resulted in a drop in momentum for the opposition?
We lost the momentum in the fall for the change of government, for the transition, of course. We didn't win in the fall. So now we are in the kind of stalemate situation. But I think time is working on us, in our favor.
Franek, how would you describe the oppression that President Lukashenko has used in this, shall we say, winter pause of protests?
I would say that's the biggest repressions in the Eastern Europe since Second World War. We see 33,000 people detained. We see more than 1,000 people under criminal charges, 10 dead. We see so many victims of torture. Eastern Europe didn't see such crackdown in dozens of years. And of course, the society is scared. Many people are in frustration and the apathy, but I think no one wants to give up.
And you're in Lithuania. How are you able to get current information like that from detention cells in Belarus? Is it through the EU and their reporting?
No, we have the wide network of people, of activists. We have 1,500 volunteers on the ground. We have human rights defenders who constantly report. We have our own agents, and we actually have our informants in the regime who are constantly leaking information to us. You know, this is why I'm pretty optimistic, because I see that so many people within the regime are collaborating with us. They also don't believe, they don't trust Lukashenko, and they want changes, but they are not ready to defect.
So earlier this week, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya called on Belarusians to attend nationwide street rallies in about a month on March 25th. So is this the path forward? More protests like last summer?
March 25th is the first date in the springtime, and I think that will be the beginning of the new wave of street protests. And also that's a remarkable date. In 1918, Belarus declared independence, and this date was prohibited by Soviet authorities and by Lukashenko's authorities. So it also has symbolic meaning, especially now when Lukashenko is going to Russia and talking to Putin and trading Belarus sovereignty.
Are you worried that Lukashenko now has the time to look at March 25th and prepare for these protests, and that could result in more detentions, more crackdowns?
Absolutely. I think they mobilize and all the resources they have, all the soldiers, all the military and paramilitary groups, I think they're preparing to disperse protests. But I think that we still will prevail.
our tactic of peaceful protest, nonviolent protest, is very efficient. When Lukashenko will start shooting people and killing people, I think he will be detained, arrested by his own people right away.
It sounds almost like you're anticipating that to happen.
That's one of the possible scenarios, because, you know, Alexander Lukashenko is not a normal European politician. He will be clinging on to the power to the end. And if he will be feeling that he is losing the control over the situation, he can take very bad decisions.
So earlier this week, Franek, Lukashenko and Russian President Vladimir Putin met in Sochi in Russia. There were photos of them skiing together, riding snowmobiles and having lunch. What do we know more about this meeting and their relationship and just generally Russia's influence on the situation in Belarus?
Actually, we don't know much because official press releases do not tell us anything. We can just guess. We know that Lukashenko came to Russia to beg for money. Lukashenko needs Russian loan badly. And we heard about $3.5 billion requested by Lukashenko, but we also heard that Putin refused. Putin didn't give him this money. I think that now they are discussing behind the scenes the offer, the deal. I think for Putin, it's very important to get some guarantees from Lukashenko in the form of Belarusian enterprises, pipeline or oil refineries, something that he can take as the guarantee that this money will be given back.
How much does that relationship with Russia and Putin concern you? I mean, clearly Lukashenko isn't budging. He might just raise the stakes, give his riot police a longer leash, or could Putin be the thing that keeps Lukashenko in check?
Putin is the only reason why Lukashenko is still in power. If Putin didn't support him in August and September, we will be living already in democratic Belarus, perhaps. But Kremlin supported Lukashenko, supported violence, ignored the democratic forces, and gave Lukashenko money in the most critical moment in October. And they also have symbiotic relationship. I think for Kremlin, Belarusian case is very scary. I think Kremlin is afraid that such a revolution as it's happening in Belarus can also take over Russian cities.
Franek Viachorka is a senior advisor to Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, the leader of the Democratic Belarus Movement. He's been speaking with us about the latest developments in Belarus from his perch in exile in Lithuania. Thank you very much for making time for us.
Thank you.
In January of last year, you'll recall that Iran's military shot down a passenger plane just minutes after it took off from Tehran's international airport. All 176 people on board were killed. Iranian officials claimed it was a mistake. They say air defense crews mistook the passenger plane for an incoming missile. At the time, tensions between the U.S. and Iran were running very high. This week, a top United Nations expert says that many questions related to the downing of the plane remain unanswered. The world's Shirin Jafari reports.
Families of the passengers on board Flight 752 from Tehran to Kiev have waited for more than a year for answers. How can a passenger plane full of people be accidentally shot out of the sky? So far, the response from the Iranian government has created more confusion than clarity, says Agnès Callamard. She's the UN Special Rapporteur on extrajudicial killings.
You know, they explain that there was a miscalibration of the radar. They do not explain how this miscalibration could have happened.
She tells me that Iran has not answered numerous questions. Why was Iranian airspace not shut down given the high tensions? Why didn't the military on the ground follow standard operating procedures? Why was the site of the crash bulldozed shortly after it happened? And why have Iranian officials harassed and intimidated grieving family members? Callamard says the list goes on, and she hopes that the government will provide some answers. The plane that took off that morning from Tehran carried passengers from several different countries. The majority, however, had connections to Canada. There were students, academics, families on a Christmas break. Among them were newlyweds Pune Gorji and Arash Purzarabi. They were both graduate students at the University of Alberta. That's where Ross Greiner teaches computing sciences. He was an advisor to Pune.
She was always positive, always upbeat, fun to be with. She agreed to be our lab's vice president in charge of fun.
She organized movie nights and camping trips. Pune's research focused on using ultrasound technology to detect health problems with babies before they are born. She was making great progress, Greiner says. But what he remembers the most about her is her kindness.
A few years ago, I had a minor bicycle accident, and I think I broke a rib, which made it painful to talk. That afternoon, I was giving a presentation that Poon was attending. As I was talking, it was obvious I was in pain. I was wincing. Later that day, she came to my office to say, "Are you okay, Russ? Anything I can do?"
Grieving has been tough, Greiner says. He's never experienced losing a student before. He's been holding classes online because of the pandemic.
We can't hold each other. We can't. You know, we can see tears. A hug would have been nice to give, to receive.
Agnes Callamard, the UN official, made her letter to the Iranian government public this week. In 45 pages, she outlines what she found following 6 months of investigation. Callamard says the Iranian government didn't stop her from conducting the investigation, but it didn't help either.
What happened is a very serious human rights violation. The mistakes that had to occur for that civilian plane to be targeted indicate a disregard for standard operating procedure that is so high that it is in fact reckless and criminal.
Last summer, Iran's Civil Aviation Organization released a report blaming human error and poor communication for the downing of the plane. Callamard says Iran's investigation does not meet international standards.
So far, the authorities have mentioned the people on the ground who are, of course, responsible in that they pull the trigger in a way or another. But there are far more individuals responsible for what happened.
Do you think these families will ever get justice?
Look, I think justice in this context is going to take time. And justice is going to demand that we outside Iran and the international community of states demand justice on their behalf.
Callamard says the government of countries with nationals on board should continue to demand accountability. For its part, the Iranian government says it has set aside about $200 million for compensation to the victims' families. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Next year, the Gulf nation of Qatar will be hosting the World Cup, and still there is a big problem with the rights of migrant workers, many of whom are helping to create the infrastructure for the biggest soccer tournament on earth. Qatar had promised to make improvements to migrant worker rights, but a new analysis from the Guardian newspaper in the UK concluded that more than 6,500 workers have died since Qatar was granted the rights to the World Cup. May Romanos, a lawyer and Gulf researcher at Amnesty International London, joins us to discuss this. So where are many of these migrant workers from that this report focuses on? And what does the report say specifically about the circumstances that are leading to this troubling number of deaths?
Most migrant workers from Qatar actually come from Southeast Asian countries, mainly from India, Pakistan, Nepal, Bangladesh, Philippines. And they come in, I think, after having paid heavy recruitment fees, having taken up loans to come and work in Qatar in search for a better job for themselves, for their families back home. They played an important and vital role in the delivery of the construction work that was needed for Qatar to host this World Cup. And sadly, I think the standards and protection that are in place are very weak in Qatar, which led to a number of them having sadly to lose their lives.
So back to this report, according to it, the causes of death are categorized as natural deaths. In this context, what exactly does this mean?
I think that's one of the major issues that we are facing when it comes to the issue of death of migrant workers in Qatar and the Gulf in general. There is a lack of transparency around the death of migrant workers, and there isn't a process in place or proper investigation that is carried out to determine the real cause of death. When healthy young migrant workers who passed their medical test and were deemed fit to work in Qatar die, there isn't any autopsy or investigation that take place, and deaths are usually referred to or categorized as natural deaths or cardiac arrest without really knowing what led to these deaths. And that's a big issue that I think we are urging Qatar to address immediately.
How has Qatar worked to improve migrant worker rights? And is there talk of either doubling down or maybe a rollback of these measures if they're not working?
There need to be recognized that Qatar has made some progress in relation to the protection of migrants' rights, especially in the lead of this World Cup. Since it was awarded the right to host this World Cup, there has been a lot of spotlight and attention to its treatment of migrant workers. And it was ultimately pushed to sign an agreement with the International Labour Organization to reform the system and that is actually leading to this exploitation. And so far, it has delivered some important labour reforms. But sadly, what we are seeing is that when these reforms look good on paper, they are not being well implemented, strictly enforced, which means that labor abuse and exploitation continue to take place in Qatar.
So is there actual resistance to making working conditions for migrant workers in Qatar and the wider Gulf better, or is there something else going on?
Yeah, obviously there is a resistance. There is the difficulty to, you know, shake the statu quo where most employers, especially companies, small and medium companies owned by locals, they make huge gains and their business model function based on this current system that is in place, which is the kafala system. And I think there has been a bit of resistance from the business community in these countries. But Qatar has showed that it has the political will at the upper level from the top to reform the system. And that's why it has committed to this program. But there is some resistance still happening. And sadly, we do see some setbacks taking place to push against these changes.
May, what would it mean for Qatar if the situation does not improve by the end of this year, going into 2022, the World Cup year? Could there be repercussions?
I mean, we would want Qatar to improve, and that's what we have been calling on Qatar to make the changes. There's a huge opportunity there for Qatar, for the Middle East, hosting this huge tournament. And I think there is hope for change. We want Qatar to make the changes that it needs. We want it to be serious. More work needs to be done. What it's doing is not enough. It's a good start, but we really want this World Cup to leave a positive legacy for all migrant workers, and we will continue to urge Qatar to do what it takes to get there.
May Romanos is a lawyer and Gulf researcher at Amnesty International, speaking with us from London. Thank you for coming on the program, May.
Thank you so much for hosting me.
We leave you today with some good news. It comes in the form of wild bison returning to the Canadian plains. Last week, a herd of 20 plains bison were released on Poundmaker Cree Nation territory in Saskatchewan. Millions of these animals once roamed Canada's plains, but today only around 1,500 remain that have not been bred with cattle over the years. This herd's introduction is a product of a partnership with Parks Canada and will be managed by a not-for-profit run by Poundmaker Cree members. We're joined by Chief Duane Antoine of the Poundmaker Cree Nation. Chief Antoine, can you describe for us what it was like to see these bison released? What were you feeling when this happened?
It was a really exciting feeling to have the buffalo roaming around in our Treaty 6 territory again. That was our traditional foods of our being sourced before the settlers came and when they started removing and slaughtering all the buffalo. But I'm glad that the buffaloes are home now and they're going to be raised here and fed here.
How is bison used for food? Is it meat and milk?
Bison was used for traditional smoked meat. In the summertime, you'd have to smoke the meat so it won't waste. That was everyday meal for our ancestry.
I saw the video from the CBC of the release of the bison, and they just took off running around the perimeter of this large prairie. They were moving fast, too. I mean, what do they sound like when they're just, like, moving like that?
There was some snow there cracking, eh? And, you can hear them running. They had a lot of speed.
Yeah, they were moving. So the herd is going to be managed by a local organization, I understand. And there's also going to be the educational cultural components. Tell us more about that.
The return of our buffalo, it's going to be educational. You know, we'll have field trips for especially the younger generation that are going to school on the reserve. We'll have a big, good impact for our younger generation.
Where had this group of 20 plains bison been raised?
They've been raised roaming through Elk Island Park in Alberta. That's in Alberta, still part of our Treaty 6 territory, and they were transported from over there to Poundmaker.
Yeah, and looking forward, what are your hopes for the future of this herd on your territory?
The future of this herd is good. They're going to multiply. Their offsprings will form a bigger impact on the reserve to have more buffalo than just 20. It's a great feeling to have them at home.
Duane Antoine, the chief of Poundmaker Cree Nation, speaking with us about the release of a herd of plains bison to the territory for the first time in a century. Congratulations. I feel are in order. Chief, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tomorrow in the world, we continue our week-long focus on the outreach needed to vaccinate the entire planet. We head to France, where the government held a lottery to select 35 members of the public to help create the country's vaccine strategy. That's tomorrow on the show. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. You be safe, stay strong. We'll see you back here tomorrow.